A surge of women in the Maine legislature. There's a lot of coverage about the new crop of women elected to Congress in November. Well, that surge didn't just happen on the national level. In Maine, voters elected a record number of women to the state legislature. 60 women are now serving in the Maine House and 12 in the Maine Senate, for a total of 72 women in the legislature, the largest number ever. In the House, both the Speaker of the House, Sarah Gideon, and House Minority Leader Kathleen Dillingham are women. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Is this wave of women in the State House just an interesting fact, or will it make a real difference in the way the State House operates? Do women legislators hold different priorities? Do they govern differently? What do you want to see from the women in the State House? Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A record 72 women will be serving in Maine's legislature this session. It is part of a wave of women entering public office across the nation. Today, we will hear from a first-time legislator as well as veteran legislators about their experiences and what issues they will focus on. Joining me, Representative Chloe Maxmitten. She is new to the legislature. She's a Democrat who was just elected to Maine's House of Representatives serving District 88, which includes Jefferson, Whitefield, Chelsea, and part of Nobleboro. Also here, Representative Sarah Gideon. She was just reelected as Speaker of the House. She's a Democrat serving her District 48, part of Freeport and Pownall. And we are hoping to hear from Representative Kathleen Dillingham, who is stepping into the role of Minority Leader for the Maine House of Representatives. She is the Republican representative for District 72, serving Mechanic Falls, Otis Field, and Oxford. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you anticipate that these women will bring a new culture to Augusta? Are there certain issues you're hoping will be priorities this year? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for joining me here. And I want to start by kind of getting your stories a little bit. Representative Gideon, I've heard you tell yours to a group of young women. You did not have an unconventional, or you did not have a conventional path to the speaker's rostrum, if there is such a thing.
That's right. I maybe didn't have a conventional path to getting involved in politics at all. I one day came home and picked up some messages on my answering machine, and there was a message for my husband. And the message said, there is an open seat on the town council, and we're wondering if Ben would like to run for that seat.
I love it. We're wondering if Ben would like to run.
All right. And so I remember picking up that message, and I immediately thought, absolutely not. Ben is not running for that seat, based simply on, at that point, our children, their ages, and the amount of time that he worked. But I almost immediately had the next thought, which was, but I think that I want to run for this seat. And that sort of began where I am today.
So from town council to what was next?
Well, I served on the Freeport Town Council for 3 years, and then I actually ran for my seat representing Freeport and Pownall in the Maine legislature. I first had a three-way primary and entered the legislature in the 126th legislature. I served 2 years on the Energy Utilities Technology Committee. Then I became assistant leader of my caucus and then speaker in the past term.
Did you know from the minute you arrived in Augusta that you wanted a leadership position?
Not from the minute I arrived, no. And when I arrived, it was really an incredibly humbling experience to be here. I think most people, when we get here as elected representatives or senators, feel just a tremendous sense of responsibility and also a tremendous sense of all of the things there are for us to learn in order to be effective and do our job. And so that is really what sort of comes at you at the beginning. And then I think as you start to get your feet under you, as you start to work on policy, both in your committee and in the chamber, that is when you start to have sort of a vision come together of what you think government should look like and how you want to participate in it. And I think for me, as as that started to become clear, I realized that in order to achieve that, it would be a natural thing for me to try to be in a leadership role in order to shape that the way I was seeing it.
So, Chloe,
yes.
How did you decide to run? Mm-hmm. Tell me how you grew up, how you got involved in politics, and congratulations on your first. This is your first elected office, correct?
It is indeed. Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for the opportunity to be on this show today. I grew up on my family's farm in Nobleboro, and for as long as I can remember, I have cared about our home and our community more than anything. When I was 12 and I first began to have a social consciousness, I decided to devote my life to fighting for Maine and fighting for our community. That's taken many forms throughout the year, mostly through the avenue of grassroots organizing, working with different communities to call on our political system to fight for us, whether it's around climate change or healthcare or education. And through all of these years, what I've seen is that we've built more people power, but our political system still isn't really fighting or working for the people. So I saw that there was an open seat in my district, District 88, and I decided to run. And not only to run to bring a different kind of politics to the Maine legislature, but also to figure out how we campaign in a different way that is inclusive and based on our common humanity and not necessarily our party.
So there's been a lot made in the national news as well as here in Maine about the number of women running for office, the number of women who've been elected to Congress. Did you feel as though you were a part of that, or was this just a solely individual decision? There's an open seat in my district and I want to run.
It was both. It was both. I've been through programs like Emerge Maine that train women to run for office, and I'm surrounded by a really incredible network of women who are thinking about politics and active in politics. But I also did it for my community. And I think that the point of having more women in office is that we need a diversity of perspectives shaping our policy. If only one group of folks is making laws and those laws only reflect that one perspective. So it's about electing more women so we have equality and diversity of voice and representation.
I understand you knocked on a few doors.
We did. Our campaign knocked on almost 10,000 doors, I believe was the final number, which is a lot for a small rural House district. But that's what it took to win. I think our districts like ours, these very rural districts, have been left behind and overlooked. Folks aren't used to having someone drive down their mile-long driveway and knock on their door and take the time to have a real honest conversation about what's happening in politics today.
Sarah, this is your second term as Speaker of the House. As you were sworn in last week and you looked around at the faces in the chamber, did you feel a noticeable difference with more women represented?
Oh, absolutely. I think, first of all, just even going back to election season and looking at all the races that we were supporting as Democrats, we had a tremendous number of women running, more than 50%, which now our caucus is more than 50% women. And even through that process, we felt such a sense of excitement. It was very purposeful on our part. We worked really hard to recruit women. And as you might know, sometimes it takes extra conversations with women to convince them that now is the time and they are the right person to do this job. And so I found myself actually last Wednesday, as I looked out, really just overwhelmed and a little emotional about it.
So I want to clarify two things. When you said more than half of our caucus, what you mean is that more than half of the Democrats in the legislature are women.
That's right. In fact, let me just say that women outnumber the men in our caucus by 9. There are 49 women and 40 men in the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives.
And you said this was purposeful. Why was it? Why was it important for Democrats in Maine to recruit women to run for office?
Well, I think this, for me, is very personal. But also, it really is reflected in what Representative Maxman just said as well. When we look at the people who are making laws, who are making decisions, evaluating policy, we need to make sure that those people are representative of the public. And for as long as we can look back and remember, that has not been the case when we look at who our elected officials are. Just plainly speaking, and the most simply put, we needed to have a representative number of women that reflected what our population looks like, because then we can actually make policy that works for everyone. And so for me as a returning speaker, it was a very purposeful decision for me and for my staff to say, now is the time that we actually really put our money where our mouth is and actually make sure that we have women representing us in government.
So one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that you will be a female Speaker of the House with a woman governor in the governor's office. Yeah. First time in Maine history. What do you all think the difference will be, not only having women in leadership in the Maine legislature, not only having so many women in the Maine legislature, but doing it all with a woman in the governor's office?
I think I've been thinking about this a lot and what exactly about it is so powerful. And I think the conclusion that I've come to is that when we think of a politician, we usually think of a man, and we think of someone who's very confident and outgoing, and we have this stereotype in our mind of what that kind of person looks like. And to have so many women and young folks and folks from different backgrounds coming into Maine politics this year, it's really a new chapter. It's because politics as usual has failed Maine and is failing our country, and we need to think about doing something different and being different in politics, and that to me is what this new wave of women represents.
What do you see? Do you think there will be different policy priorities? Do you think it'll be a different culture, or are you talking about something else?
Well, since it's my first term, it's hard for me to compare in past sessions what the culture has been like. But I think that it's absolutely vital that we have people from different backgrounds and identities representing the people in our communities and just shaping our policy in different ways. I mean, just like me and my brother think about the world in a different way, me and my mom think about the world in a different way. And that is what it takes to make policy that works for everybody.
Okay, Sarah, what do you think? Do you think there will be different priorities this session?
So, Jennifer, in answer to your question, I think that both in terms of policymaking and in terms of how we do things, that we'll see things shift a little bit. So in terms of policy, I think we've been saying this for a while. There's no such thing as a women's issue, yet people have talked about proverbial women's issues. It's just that there are issues that sometimes affect women first, and then those very same issues affect every single one of us, women, men, children. But what I think we'll see differently is that with so many women in the legislature making those policies, that we'll really be focusing on them and saying, how do we find a way that we are lifting everyone? And how do we really prioritize those things? So, for example, issues like paid family leave, making sure that in this world that we live in now, where people are sandwiched between taking care of their children and taking care of their aging parents, that they're actually able to keep their jobs, feel secure in them, do great work, but also take care of their family.
What are your priorities for policy issues?
Yes. Well, my goal as a representative is to truly reflect the values of my community and especially the conversations that I've heard knocking on doors for the past 8 months. And it was interesting when I started knocking, I thought that the number one thing that I would hear from people would be a solid issue like healthcare, education, or property taxes. But the number one thing that I heard is that we don't have a government that listens to our voices anymore or that really represents us anymore. So my number one priority for this session is to stay in touch with my community, to be connected, to make the effort to be accessible and transparent and accountable, and to try and figure out how we make sure that we're engaging with politics beyond Election Day.
All right. Well, I understand Representative Dillingham is unable to call in today. I'm sorry to hear that. She's going to be the Maine House Republican leader, the minority leader. So, Sarah, that means that you will be working with her when you work with issues that are across the aisle. I mean, I don't think it's any secret that the House of Representatives has been very divided for a lot of years. Do you see that changing? And if you do see it changing, is it because there are going to be women leading both caucuses?
Well, first, I do see it changing. I already see the change. And in working with Representative Dillingham to date, just over the past couple of weeks, and starting to organize what the House will look like, what our committees will look like, I have found her to be just an incredibly open person who really believes in the institution of government and the legislature and wants it to work. And that's how I feel, too. And I think, therefore, we just start from this very common place. I don't know if it's because we're two women or because of our personalities or just because we are people who are dedicated to the idea of making government work and making government work for people. But I feel a tremendous amount of optimism looking forward. And I have this feeling, which is really one of the first things that I learned in politics at the local level, which is that we don't have to have the same ultimate goals, or sometimes we do have the same goals, but different ways of getting there. And yet we can work together every single day and get good things done and compromise and respect each other. And that, I think, at the very beginning and the very end of every single day is what I have looked for and what I will still look for and what I feel that sense of optimism about.
It is hard to tease out sometimes whether something's because of something like a gender role or if it's just somebody's personality. So it really is going to be difficult to tease out, I suspect, with so many new legislators, not just women, a new governor, new constitutional officers, all except for Matt Dunlap. So things will be different. And I do realize that some of this is speculation and guessing about what's going to be different. Tell me about your class, Chloe. What do you think? You've now known them for a couple weeks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The new legislative class. How would you describe them? How would you and how do you, when you're home with your friends, what do you tell them about the people you're serving with that are new to the legislature?
The first thing that I say is that I'm so excited and honored to serve with all of the folks coming in and all the folks who have already been doing the hard work in the state legislature. There are so many people who are just coming in with this different energy and different perspectives, and I really think that's what we need in politics today. They're also folks who have knocked on doors in their community, and they're truly representing, because everybody has just come off the campaign trail, and we really know what's going on. And I've seen folks staying true to what they heard at the doors and trying to implement it in every way they can in just these past 2 weeks that we've been in Augusta.
Well, we're talking about the wave of women in the Maine legislature. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Portland Pottery with its 28th annual holiday show featuring more than 90 artists, opening December 14th. PortlandPottery.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, helping businesses with local service and decision making. Bangor Savings Bank, you matter more. Member FDIC. Maine's Political Pulse, a new weekly discussion on the politics of our state with our two top Maine Public News political reporters, Mal Leary and Steve Missler, is now heard each Friday morning on Morning Edition with Erwin Gratz. An expanded version of Maine's Political Pulse for on-demand listening or as a podcast is available each Friday afternoon after 2 at mainepublic.org/politicalpulse, or you can just click on News. You've heard the tones before here on Maine Public Radio and perhaps also on Maine Public Television. Maine Public is the designated primary source for the entire state of Maine emergency alert system, which we transmit to all other stations for broadcast to all listeners and viewers all around the state. This is a valuable and important public service tool to help inform, alert, and warn citizens when situations warrant, and Maine Public's statewide infrastructure enables it to fulfill this vital task and public service.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, more women in Maine's legislature. Joining me here in our Augusta studio, Chloe Maxman, who is newly elected to Maine's House of Representatives, serving District 88, and Sarah Gideon, House Speaker. She serves District 48. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with a call from Bangor. This is Larry. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to give a little international perspective to all of this. There are only two countries, Rwanda and Bolivia, with majority of women in their parliaments. And I think there's something wrong here. It's considering the fact that women are half the population. I think it's a matter of discrimination and a cultures that devalue women in politics. And one solution I would suggest are quotas. 118 countries right now, or as of a few years ago, have some kind of a quota system to increase the number of women in politics. And I think U.S. is not one of those. I think we in the U.S. should consider adopting some sort of a quota system so that they become half of the lawmakers and half of the heads of state.
All right. What do you all think of that idea?
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much for your comments and your ideas. I have to say that I have never had that idea proposed to me, and I had not organically thought of it myself. I think right now I would say it's an interesting idea, and I would love to see us continue, and we have to continue to increase the number of women. I think there are people who would be tempted to call, for example, this year nationally across the U.S. a year of the woman. And I say it's not. It is simply us stepping into the present and continuing to build the future, which I think means that we continue to build more women in government at all levels.
Absolutely. And I think it's also about having the conversations in our communities about gender and the way that we view the world. And a lot of that happens at very local levels when we're knocking on doors or having events in our community.
All right. Well, Larry, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to go next to an email. This is from Ann Lynn in Bar Harbor. She says, I volunteered as an election official working in the polling place lobby. A woman candidate spent the rainy day standing outside and holding the door open for voters. Her male opponent spent the day inside backslapping and bantering. To me, it just summed up the situation of women having to work harder to get ahead. With some justice, the woman won. So Ann Lynn's story from Election Day. I have to say, at my polling place, everybody was standing together and working hard together. So, and then Karen from Cooper, Maine writes, I welcome more women in Maine government. I look forward to working with them. As a woman political activist, I will ask their help to support a new version of a bill that would be submitted to the Maine legislature. It would stop unfair double taxation of some retirees. Also, I and many others will ask them to actively support our efforts at the federal level to repeal or reform the windfall elimination provision and government pension offset. Both impact retirees, and the GPO especially does so to women. Sarah, is this an issue that you're tracking?
Assuming I have the right issue here, which I think is an issue that primarily affects educators, then yes, this is an issue I think we have long recognized as a major problem and that we need to find the solution for. I think the solution has obviously escaped us to date, but without question, I would like to work on this issue, work with my colleagues on this issue, and fix it.
Yes, I've actually heard a lot about the windfall elimination provision from,
have you been
from my constituents. Yeah, a lot of folks have brought it up to me, and it does require a federal fix. But I think that we can still do a lot at the state level to make sure that our voices are represented at the federal level.
We'll go to Lila, who's calling from Wiscasset. Hi, Lila. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. In the 126th legislature, they created the Commission on the Status of Women. It's under the Secretary of State's office, and I'm curious, number one, whether it still exists. It was created, Sarah, to look at every piece of legislation that went through the State House to determine how it would affect women and children. So just a comment on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
So, hi, Lila, and thank you for your both bringing that to everyone's attention who's listening. And yes, that does continue to exist. And I think as we move forward into the 129th legislature, as we look to really modernize everything we do in this body, that we need to make sure that that commission actually has the ability to work as it's intended to do, and that the determinations that come out of that commission are not just reported, but actually listened to, and that we take them very seriously.
Lila, thank you for your call. Moving on to Portland and Rich. Hi, Rich. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for letting me ask a question. I'm wondering if there's any policy priorities for the representatives this session around ending child poverty, or at least addressing child poverty, the high rates of child poverty here in Maine, and the continued crisis in child welfare in the state. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Hi, Rich. So this is Sarah again, and then I'll turn the mic over to Chloe. But thank you so much for that question. The answer is an absolute and resounding yes. This has been an issue that I think many people, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, care a lot about, and yet we have seen over the past decade in Maine, largely we've seen children who are food insecure or living in poverty continue to do worse until very recently. Personally, I have worked on this issue. It's been one of the issues that I've worked most closely on for the past 2 years, and will be continuing to do that next year, focusing very specifically on how we continue to build programs for families with children living at home that bring them out of poverty and help them sustain a life out of poverty and continue to do better and better through education, through training, through help with transportation, through access to food and a roof over their heads.
Thank you, Rich. This is definitely one of the biggest things on my radar. The highest rates of poverty in my district are amongst children, so it's something that I heard about a lot while I was campaigning. I echo what Sarah said. I think it's about having the government resources in place, you know, and making sure that all children have access to Head Start and making sure that they have the support around them to get the education that they need from when they're little all the way through technical, vocational, or college education so that they can succeed in life, and also supporting local food pantries and food banks and making sure that no child is going hungry in our state.
Rich, thank you for your call. We'll go from phones to, let's see here, to a Facebook post. Question for Sarah Gideon. This is from Mary. What do you think about the referendum process? Is it bypassing the legislature too much?
Hi, Mary. Thank you for that question. And, you know, this is a question, quite honestly, that I struggle with for a couple of reasons. So, first of all, I think that having a referendum process is important. And I think that we have seen a number of instances where the legislature is unable to come together and address an issue that really affects people and really needs to be looked at and solved. And that's where a referendum process can be extremely valuable to really push us to do our jobs. On the flip side of that, as somebody who has served in the legislature and worked really hard on policymaking, I do recognize that there is so much information and research and listening that goes into making good policy. When we do something, it never has one single effect. It has multiple effects. And it's really important, and I think this is where the legislative process is valuable, that we are able to understand all of those things and continue to create and shape legislation that makes sense across the board. So in that way, I'd rather see things done through the legislative process. And yet, quite honestly, I do see value to the referendum process as well.
Chloe, what is your feeling about the referendum process and what's happened in the last few years in Maine?
Yes, well, my perspective is a little bit more on the outside. I think that the referendum process is really critical. I think citizens deserve every avenue for voice that we can. Things are often different on the inside of the political system than on the outside. But I think that there's also a frustration around referendum processes in Maine right now because we've passed so many that haven't been implemented. And that makes the people feel like, well, we all feel like, okay, well, what was the point of voting on it if it wasn't implemented? Do our voices really matter? And I think that effect is cascading to the point of, should I even vote in this election? So I think it's important, and I think it's important that we abide the will of the voters.
All right. Is this something you've had discussions with some of the other representatives who are newly elected? I'm wondering if this was one of the issues that propelled people to run for the legislature.
I can't recall a specific conversation, but I think the whole idea of what does representation really mean? How do you balance all of the views in your community and the state? I think that's an idea that a lot of folks are really thinking about in positive ways.
All right. We'll go to Bruce, who's calling from Sinclair. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I'm just wondering, considering that the bill to ban subjecting children to gay conversion therapy failed earlier this year, and due in large part to Democrats who refused to override the current governor's veto, I'm just wondering if the women legislators of Maine will reintroduce this important bill.
Hi, Bruce. So this bill is definitely going to be reintroduced, and I can tell you that I and my fellow caucus members are dedicated to banning conversion therapy in Maine. And additionally, and really positively, Governor-elect Mills has come out very strongly to say that this is one of her highest priorities as well. So I am very confident that we will get this done. It has no place anywhere in this country, and it certainly doesn't have any place in Maine.
Cooper on Facebook writes, will there be any kind of mathematical approach to creating policies that truly reflect our demographics? I generally feel there's very little emphasis given to our aging population simply because they don't communicate in a social media fashion. So they end up being politically quiet when there are so many in need.
I can start on that one. Three of the four towns in my district are in Lincoln County, which is the oldest county by age in the country. So we do have, and that's not specific to Lincoln County. Maine is a very old state. And so many of the folks that I talk to are elderly folks who do not have the ability to leave their home, who are really struggling whether to put food on their table or to buy their medications. And those are truly the kinds of voices that I have in my head every day. There are big parts of my district that don't have access to internet and that don't have cell phones. And so I think about how we bring services to folks who aren't connected in the ways that most of us are. And honestly, to me, the foundation of it is door knocking, going and talking with people, making sure that during campaign season, and even not in campaign season, that we're taking the time to connect with these folks and remembering their names and where they live and their stories and writing down what they need, because it's that relationship that is going to be the core of our solutions.
So one of the legislature's youngest new legislators is going with the needs of your older constituents.
Yes.
On her mind.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go to Sean, who's calling from Orland. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Chloe, this is a question for you. I understand that you have some experience and history with the Emerging Environmental Changemakers, which is a group dedicated to creating diversity and inclusion in the environmental sector. And I'm curious to know how much your work with that group informed or affected your progress towards your current success in being elected and your policy priorities looking forward.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Sean. The Changemakers program is really wonderful and incredible. They're run through the Maine Education Association, and I've had the honor of working with those folks for the past couple years. I've devoted so much time to MIA, as we call it, because they're looking at the climate movement and environmentalism through a justice lens, which means that it's about inclusivity, making sure that all voices are included, no matter your background, where you live, the color of your skin, who you love. And it's that kind of diversity of representation and voice that I think we need in politics. And in all of the movements that we're working on, so many of the issues that we're facing today, they transcend any single identity. They impact all of us. And if the movements that we're building don't represent that diversity and all of those identities, then we're never going to be able to craft any solution, whether it's at the grassroots level or in Augusta or in D.C., that can really reach all those people and understand all of the struggles and challenges and hopes and opportunities that we have.
Sean, thank you for your call. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll have Emily Kane, former legislative leader here in Maine and now the head of the national organization Emily's List. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. Penobscot Financial Advisors, who believe everyone deserves a fiduciary. Learn more at penobscotadvisors.com. And Freeport Wild Bird Supply, a destination for bird enthusiasts for nature gifts, feeding supplies, and guided tours. FreeportWildBirdSupply.com.
Millions of women become pregnant in the U.S. each year. If they have a chronic health problem or become ill, it's often not clear how to handle their care.
Each doctor had a different opinion on what I could and could not be doing.
In part, that's because historically, pregnant women have been excluded from medical research. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening right here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Television consists of four unique channels these days, our Maine HD channel, and also Create, World, and PBS Kids, all of which are offered free and over the air. PBS Kids offers 24/7 commercial-free educational children's programming you can trust whenever you want. And that's not it, wherever you want as well. We also offer PBS Kids for online streaming on your mobile devices. To find out more, visit mainepublic.org and click on television or see your Experience member magazine. PBS Kids is a digital channel and, similar to World and Create, can be seen over the air and on most cable channels in our state. Enjoy.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Women Legislators in Maine. Joining me, Sarah Gideon, Maine House Speaker, and Chloe Maxman, who's a first-time representative. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now, Emily Kane. You may recognize her name because she's former Maine House Minority Leader, State Senator, and two-time Democratic Congressional candidate. She is now the Executive Director of Emily's List. And Emily, I've known about Emily's List for a long time. It wasn't named for you.
No, Emily's List was not named for me, Jennifer, but I'm so glad to be on today to talk about it.
Well, tell Emily's me what List, Emily's yeah. List does.
Sure.
Go ahead.
So Emily's List has been around for 33 years, working to elect pro-choice Democratic women at every level of government, from school boards and mayors and state legislatures through governors and members of Congress and the U.S. Senate, and ultimately President of the United States. We work with candidates early on to help them build their campaigns. And Emily, actually, I should say, is not a person. Emily is an acronym. It stands for Early Money Is Like Yeast. It makes the dough rise. And early on when Emily's List started, we started with the premise that if we could help women raise small dollar grassroots contributions for their campaigns, then they would be able to attract the larger dollars that follow and build big campaigns. And we started that work 33 years ago, and we haven't stopped since, electing record numbers of women to the U.S. Senate, the House, governorship, state legislatures, and this year hitting new highs pretty much across the board.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that climate. What's the climate like nationally, and what was it like for you when you were serving in Maine's legislature? It wasn't that long ago. Have things changed a little, a lot, or has there been a sea change?
Well, when I first got to the Maine legislature, I was elected in 2004, which is hard to believe. It was 14 years ago. And I went on to serve for 10 years. And what I know is when I first got there, we were at about 25-26% women when I first started. At that point, we'd only ever had one woman Speaker of the House. We had only just had our first woman Senate president the year before with Bev Daggett. And a lot's happened over the last 14 years. Now, after this election, the Maine legislature is more than 38% women. That's a huge jump, even just from last cycle when it was 34%. So we're seeing great change, not just in the number of women, but in the diversity of the experience they bring. We now have had several women speakers of the House, including my friend Sarah Gideon on the program today. And also we've had an increasing number of younger women, including new Representative Maxim, who's on today. You know, when I was elected in 2004, I was the youngest member elected that year. I was 24 years old. And now it seems, I think there were five of us under the age of 35 at that point. Now, the age diversity in the Maine legislature is really part of the positive story to tell that ultimately will be to the benefit of the people of the state of Maine.
So we're doing a story, a show today on women in the Maine legislature, but maybe we ought to be doing a program on age diversity in the Maine legislature. That's an interesting point, Emily. I know that my guests want to say hi to you.
Hi, Emily. I just wanted to say keep up the great work and congratulations for this past November.
Thank you. Thank you, Speaker Gideon. And I will say, you know, this past cycle, Emily's List expanded our state and local work to unprecedented levels. We nearly quadrupled the size of the staff and I think doubled the number of states we were working in, our legislative chambers we were working in. And Maine was on our list from the very beginning to expand the Democratic majority in the House and to flip the Maine Senate. We ultimately made 19 endorsements this year in the state legislature and also in a couple of district attorneys' races. And I'm very proud to report that 12 of those women won. These were endorsements in flip seats or important holds, and that two of them were two of the women that flipped the state Senate. And so I feel very good about the partnership we were able to have with Speaker Gideon and as well as with women leaders in the Senate and their staff to make sure we could bring key resources and support from trainings, advice, honestly, every once in a while, a good pep talk, and to bring some camaraderie and sisterhood for these women to make sure they knew that we had their back, not only myself as a Maine voter, but that Emily's List was also there to support them every step of the way.
Well, Emily Kane, thank you for calling in from Washington, D.C. Emily Kane, Executive Director of Emily's List, a national organization dedicated to recruiting women into political office. We're going to go to an email from Monica, if I can get my computer to check. There we go. She writes, "This is a heartwarming conversation, and I do feel optimistic. I'd like to ask Chloe, who seems dedicated to truly representing her district, how she defines representation on issues in which her constituents are deeply divided."
That is a very good question, Monica, and one that I have thought about a lot, as I know I will be encountering that situation very soon. I think I devoted so much of my time to knocking on doors because I really wanted to understand what was going on in my very rural, overlooked district where we were the first Democrat to be elected. And I talked with Republicans and independents and Democrats and folks from all across the political spectrum to really understand how we're looking at all the issues that we're facing today. So that is my main bellwether. But when people elected me, and it's the honor of my life to represent my community, there's also a degree where they place their trust in me or any representative in our judgment and the information that we have access to. And that is one of the things that I want to be transparent about as a representative, not to keep my decisions behind closed doors, but to be very open about why I voted the way I do, and also to make sure that I'm always accessible to my constituents and meeting them where they're at and not making them always come to me.
A couple emails and Facebook posts on the topic. Somebody earlier in the program wanted to know if Maine's legislature or any of our guests have considered the idea of having quotas. And two people have expressed their opposition to that. Henry says, "What a terrible idea to have quotas for women in government or for anything else in life." And Mary on Facebook says, "As a woman feminist and once card-carrying member of NOW, I find the quota idea appalling." We'll move on to Orono and Steve. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, great show. Yeah, I'm a testament to the great job of Emily Kane, who, if they had a production meter for someone in the state legislature, she was a champion. And she knew how to bridge the gap and get stuff done, so I'm sure people will use her. She was fantastic, and we miss her here in Orono. But I have three things that I thought would be on the committee's radar in the legislature, which would be domestic violence. And we know what happens, half the murders, half the deaths in the state are related to domestic violence, and probably, you know, almost 100% of those would be female. Pay in the workplace, female, lagging, as well as a national, is not just Maine, is sexual harassment. So I'm hoping those three things are on the radar screen, and they certainly, I believe them to be mostly to women's women's health, mostly on women's issues, but certainly it does good, and congratulations to all the females who won the race, and I think that they will be absolutely better for it. So I'll listen offline.
Thanks, Steve.
Hi, Steve. Thank you very much. This is Sarah speaking. So domestic violence, sexual harassment, equal pay, those are issues without question that the legislature will be working on. In terms of domestic violence issues, I think we will be continuing to work on, there's a lot of work left to do. We know that. And my staff and I were just having a conversation very specifically about that this morning and how we were going to work on that. Sexual harassment, you know, last year in the legislature, we only worked on it within the legislature. And I actually wanted to be able to work on a much broader bill that would deal with sexual harassment in the workplace. And we were not able to get it through legislative council so that it could be heard. And so that is a must do. And we will be tackling that issue this year. And look, equal pay for equal work. It doesn't matter what your gender is. It doesn't matter who you are. That should be the standard, and we should accept nothing less.
I absolutely echo what Sarah said. I think they have to be political priorities because they're the priorities and realities of so many people in our state.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Steve. If you'd like to join the conversation, we just have a few minutes left. The phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Going to George in Fayette, I think. There we go. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Yes. This goes back a ways. I was wondering what Representative Gideon felt about this. The state passed LD1. Several years back now, which promised to pay 55% of education. Then they turned around and created EPS, the Central Programs and Services, the funding formula, which then defined what the state would pay for in that 55%, which left a huge gap in programs that the state paid for. And then in the last 8 years or so, they redefined EPS again by changing the state pension fund, taking it out of the state's responsibility and putting it onto the local taxpayer, which was another $49 million that was shifted to the local taxpayers. And now the administrative cost of running schools has been shifted to the local budget as well. Now, this affects all of Maine's mostly old folks that pay property tax, because most of the property taxes of rural Maine is about 65 to 70-something percent of the property taxes, comes from the school funding. And I was wondering if she had any thoughts of the other representative there about tackling how the cost shifting of property tax from education problem exists today. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Hi, George. I love your town and beautiful Echo Lake, for starters. Thank you so much for your question and your observations and your synopsis of the history of how the state funds education. And I will say, I think that there are two primary issues here. One is that no matter where a child lives in this state, they should be able to have access to an excellent education, and one that's equal to a child somewhere else in the state, and that should ultimately always be our goal. But secondarily, there is the issue that through the years, we have continued to, as you noted, put the burden of funding education increasingly on the municipalities. And we've done that in a way that then puts immense pressure on people and their homes, and especially elderly people, and property taxes. And we haven't only done that with education, but we've also done that with something called revenue sharing. And, you know, the amount of money that the state sends back to municipalities from sales tax. And it's just not right. And it is absolutely something that we have to meet our responsibility on for our students and for every single person in Maine who, at the end of the day, needs to have consistency and reliability and knowing what it's going to take to stay in their home. So you can bet that we are going to be tackling that issue this year. Getting to 55% is probably another $200 million, I would estimate. So it is a very large sum of money. Getting to the 5% of revenue sharing that the state should be paying is, I believe, about $60 to $70 million per percentage point. And so we have a lot of work to do, and we are going to have to sit down and think about and prioritize how we do it and how we actually fulfill not just our promises, but the law.
Thank you, George, for bringing this up. I've had so many conversations about this with folks in my district, one of the rural districts with very high property taxes, because we are funding so much of our public school budgets. I think on a broader level, it's definitely one of the biggest examples of how we feel in our communities that our government hasn't really listened to our voices and isn't really looking out for us. We feel like if our government worked for us, then why are our property taxes so high? Why can't I afford to stay in my home because I'm paying a school budget that the state should be paying? So I think it plays into this larger theme that we're talking about today and in this political season in general about how we make sure that our government is truly reflecting the interests and really representing the people.
George, thanks for your question. I'm going to move on to Dorothea, who's calling from Knox County. And Dorothea, we're running really short on time, so if you can be quick, that would be great.
Oh, okay. I was responding to one of the callers about senior citizens. It's true, they're not familiar with a cell phone like me. They don't have transportation, and you have to hire it out. And there's really no representation, because once you don't have transportation, once you don't have the cell phone, you're isolated, and you're on the invisible heap. You know that story about the black person, invisible boy? Well, that's the way people, older people feel. So I want to address that issue and to say that transportation east and west on Route 17 would be a good idea. And I
Dorothea,
have it all planned
thank
out.
You very much. Yeah, thank you for calling. And you have two representatives nodding and smiling and listening to you right now. McGilly on Facebook writes, I just wanted to express how excited I am to hear these voices in this context at this time in history. This is truly remarkable and a wonderful moment in Maine. I grew up in Oxford and graduated from Oxford Hills High School with Representative Dillingham. I'm sorry she can't join you today. I'm sure she'd be a valuable voice on the show and will be an important contributor as minority leader. I just want to remind and encourage the sentiment expressed by Chloe about staying, and I cannot read the rest. I cannot get my screen to scroll. I'm sorry, McGilly, but I think we get the gist that you are excited about hearing these voices on Maine Calling today. And I want to thank our guests for joining us today. We have Speaker of the House, Sarah Gideon with us right now, as well as Representative Chloe Maximum, a first-time legislator. Nikki Shields ran the board today. We had production help from John Keimel and Gil Maxwell. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.